This episode is brought to you by Dreammakers, an amazing organization that comes alongside youth who have aged out of the foster care system by connecting them to our resources so they can navigate their life with help and support and tangible gifts. Dreammakersproject.org. Thanks to our sponsor, Seminary Now. Seminary Now is an amazing online streaming platform where you can get video resources to help you grow in your faith, from deep theological studies to lessons in social justice and spiritual integration. SeminaryNow.com/cuss and put in cuss30 for a discount for MLA listeners.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
Hey friends, my guest today is William Vanderblumen. I'm really excited to chat to William for a number of reasons. He's very well known for his company, Vanderblumen, particularly here in North America, probably one of the top or the top two go-to companies when churches are looking for staff. That makes William an expert on a number of levels. First of all, he has been a lead pastor himself. In fact, he was a freakishly young lead pastor of a very large church for years. But in the last 15 years, he founded and leads a search firm. And that means he knows a lot about post-pandemic reality, what to look for, whether you're listening to this as a board or a church leader or a pastor yourself. He recently released a study where he looked at, on average, 30,000 job interviews. And his book that's being released this week, Be the Unicorn, 12 Data-Driven Habits That Separate the Best Leaders from the Rest. William, welcome to Managing Leadership Anxiety.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Steve. I appreciate it. Listeners don't believe everything you hear when Steve says all those nice things. So I think I was just well, more of a freak than freakishly young as a pastor. But
it's true, right? You were 31 years of age when you took over a church of several thousand people?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I was the youngest pastor in the city, pastoring the oldest church in Houston. It's where Sam Houston went to church. It's kind of funny. I didn't know how far out of my depths I was when I walked in there. I thought the water line was here. It was actually probably up here. And, you know, about the only thing I had going for me really was I was 31, which meant I knew everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they were kind people and a great church. And I would never be able to do what I get to do now had I not done that. And I, you know, I know your listeners are, you got a lot of pastors that listen. And I just, man, I can't thank you who are listening enough for serving in the church in this time. I had a lot of anxious moments as a pastor, but I didn't have to live through a pandemic and I didn't have to live past a pandemic. And I don't know, you know, what it's going to look like in heaven, but I got them in my mind's eye. They're going to be badges, you know, like Pioneer Clubs or Royal Ambassadors, or and there's going to be a pretty big badge that said, yeah, I did the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I can't thank you enough. I know it's harder than ever. I know it's probably more anxiety ridden than ever, but I just, anything I can do to help people who are on the front lines, like your listeners, I'm here to serve.
I love that you're telling us that, because obviously Vanderblumen is more than simply a placement company. You actually do resource and equip church leaders on both sides of the hire, right? You're helping boards and elders and so on, but you're also helping candidates and transition. William, let's get into this book, Be the Unicorn. Fantastic title. Tell us about the impetus for writing this one.
Well, we'll find out if it's a fantastic title. I kind of insisted on the title. My publisher, who I love and has been great to work with, wanted a more businessy, plain vanilla sort of thing. And I'm just not plain vanilla. And we batted around words. What we were trying to decide, Steve, was how do you title a book? Because the title is half of the book, you know. And the book was this, trying to answer this question. Have you ever walked in a room and you meet somebody and within 5 minutes, you know, they're just really special as a person. I've had it happen to me at social functions. You walk in and you meet someone, like they're just people. They're like a human magnet. They're drawing people to themselves. You see it in churches. You see I was not smart as a volunteer recruiter as a pastor, but the smart ones stand in the lobby or have others stand in the lobby and watch to see who those human magnets are, and then you recruit them to your volunteers, like that kind of person. Or you meet somebody in a job interview and you think, I need to hire them. Now I'm not 31, so I don't know everything anymore. And now I've learned to say, someone needs to hire them. It might not be me, but there's just a special quality. Do you know what I mean when I say that?
Yeah.
So the question been rattling around in my mind is, how in the world does someone make that kind of impression on me that quickly? Right? What's the formula for that? Could that be teachable or learnable? I've wondered it forever. What is the likability factor? How do people stand out like that? So during the pandemic, we serve churches, we serve schools, we serve nonprofits, we serve some businesses, all sort of Team Jesus trying to help move the church forward. And probably 85% of our clients were all shut down indefinitely during the pandemic, right? That'll change your P&L. It also changes your calendar. We didn't have, okay, what do we do? Do we just close up? Do we send everybody home and furlough them? And we decided we'd do two things. We said, no, we did have to right size. We said, okay, if you're here, then we had one line. We said, serve, don't sell. And we're just going to serve the church during the pandemic. We became kind of the hub for PPP resources here in the U.S., which is money the federal government dispersed to companies that kept their payroll intact during the pandemic. We put on how do you do virtual church in a church of 200 kind of things. And then the second thing we did was we said, now we've actually got some time to do some research, because we've been growing every year. And for 15 years, we've not had time to drop back. So when we had this extra time, we said, okay, maybe we can answer this question. What makes somebody special in 5 minutes? And how do you know? And so in a search, like say a church calls us and said, we'd like you to assist us in identifying who the next pastor God's calling to be here is. So, okay. So we do a search. Maybe there, 1,000, 1,500 people that show some interest in that search, either from me reaching them or them knowing us or what have you. Of that 1,500, and I'm just throwing numbers out, but maybe you've got 150 that are actually people that might match up once you've seen some, information about them. And then you might have dozens and dozens that you do Zoom interviews with and initial phone calls and listen to sermons. When you get down to the final group, maybe the last 6 to 10, okay, that level of talent warrants a long format, like a 3-hour face-to-face interview with us. Okay. So during the pandemic, we realized those long format interviews that were just for the top 6 to 10, we've now done 30,000 of those. And we've been tracking those interviews. There's a format, right? It's not cookie cutter, but there's a general rhythm to the thing. So we said, okay, well, we got time. Could we identify, of the 30,000 that are the best people we've encountered, could we identify who are the best of those? So we looked at who impressed us in the interview, who got the job, who stayed in the job, who's become irreplaceable, even who's moved on to a promotion, that sort of thing. And we were able to identify it, the best of the best of the best. And then we asked the question, do they have anything in common? And the answer was yes. And the answer was, on the one hand, stunning, and on the other hand, encouraging. It was stunning. I would have thought, okay, must be they've all got an IQ of 150 or more, right? Nope. Must be they've got an educational pedigree. They went to Ivy League or what have you. Nope. Maybe it's they were all 6 feet tall with great hair and teeth. Nope. The commonalities were not anything that was social class or physical makeup. It was habits. And we identified these 12 habits that these best of the best tended to exhibit. And there was drop off after the 12 to the next set. And it's like, this might be, maybe we've discovered kind of the 12 habits that if you put your energy into focusing on these things, you will be one of those people who stand out in the crowd. And so the short version is, you know, for 15 years, people have been hiring me to go find the next unicorn for their staff. You know what I mean? Like the special, irreplaceable, mythical. And I've gotten pretty good at spotting unicorns. Now I can train you to become one. I hope this really helps a lot of people because it's a more crowded job market than ever. And for pastors looking for staff, how do you know when you got people moving around and there's a great resignation? How do you know who should be the next person on your staff? I think this is going to help people who want to stand out of the crowd and team leaders who are trying to figure out, is this a volunteer that would make a big difference in our ministry? Or is this my next associate pastor or what? So I go too long, Steve. I'm a recovering preacher.
Yeah, sure. No, I think it's extremely helpful. And also what you're saying is very captivating. Like the thing I'm listening to most as I'm listening to you is you're saying this is not wiring and personality. This is skills that any of us can cultivate. You've been teasing us. I wonder if you'd either list all 12 or give us a couple of them that we can
get our mind around. Sure. Well, so here's the thing, Steve. What we discovered is these are 12 habits that are extremely common among the unicorns of the world, okay, and extremely uncommon among everybody else. And they're not unachievable. So, yeah, it's like, I try and run, jog slowly, right? And when I started, I was 60 pounds heavier than I am now. I just quit smoking 2.5 packs of cigarettes a day. I quit on Ash Wednesday. It was pretty funny. And I couldn't run downhill back to my house from campus 400 yards. So I would back up one telephone pole a day. And I remember a friend of mine saying, oh, it's too bad you don't have a treadmill. And I was like, I don't know that buying a treadmill is going to make me run. And I don't know if that I've done too much of this where I bought a piece of fitness equipment thinking it's going to make me. No, no equipment will teach you these habits. There's no book I can write that will make you start doing these things. It really will become, all right, I've identified for you what you need to do to become a unicorn. Now you have to actually do the work. It's not hard. It's just really uncommon.
Yeah.
So maybe one, you know, I was thinking about your podcast, which I'm so glad you're doing. I mean, this whole anxiety, mental illness, like this is very, very real. And we hear it all the time. I mean, you should see our inbox on a Monday morning. It's, you know, that's when, in fact, early in the company's life, I used to have an automatic, when I was the only phone number, automatic voicemail on Mondays that said, it's Monday. It's going to get better. Call me again tomorrow. So thinking about, you know, like which of these 12 might really speak to the work that you're trying to get done for the kingdom, self-awareness is probably the most uncommon trait among the people we've surveyed. And yet it's very common among those who stand out in the crowd. And that takes a lot of work. You know, it's not just I like this kind of thing and I don't like that. It's really getting to know how has God uniquely wired you and what does that make you particularly good at doing? It probably means having some idea of when anxiety is going to hit you and have you gone to Steve to figure out how to manage that or to manage it in a room. But the self-aware are very, very rare. We surveyed. So we had the 30,000 interviews, and then we identified the 12 categories. And then once we had the 12, we hired a research analyst to help us build a survey. And we administered a survey about these 12 qualities to 250,000 people. And so we got all these answers back. And one of the questions was just very straightforward. Where would you rank yourself in terms of self-awareness? 91% of everybody we surveyed said they were above average in self-awareness. Now, I'm no like statistician, but I'm pretty sure 90% of people are not above average at anything. And you're asking about self-awareness, and the stats immediately show most people have no clue how unaware they are about themselves and what their weaknesses are and their strengths and how they can serve God in a unique way in their day and time.
Okay, so William, we're at a pivotal crossroad here in this interview, because on the one hand, you've given us one of the 12 traits, and I know many of my listeners right now are thinking to themselves, Steve, if he doesn't give us all 12, you need to ask him more gauntlet questions. So that's one of my dilemmas. On the other hand, we could spend the whole episode talking about self-awareness. I would like to dig in on two aspects of this, William. I'd love to get your take on this. The first one is, when we first started chatting, you talked about that magnet in the room, and that screams two things. That screams healthy leader that's able to build something and develop, and it also screams narcissistic leader that should we should be suspicious of. I'd love to get your take on that second one, because self-awareness to me is the it factor there.
That's right.
And I'm not interested in naming names, but since 2018, we have plenty of very magnetic personalities we could be talking about who, as it turns out, were either not self-aware, or, William, sometimes people are self-aware and they don't care. Like, they'll say, this is just the way it is. You have to deal with it. They're self-aware, but they don't actually care about the impact. I'd love to get your reaction to that.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. You know, when we studied, I started with the how does somebody make an impression in 5 minutes, where the study led us was, let's see who actually got the job, performed in the job, highly likable, promotable, that sort of thing. So in my estimation, narcissists sooner or later, it's a house of cards, right? The people that last are not in that category.
Yeah.
To me, self-awareness is the key. Now, I have talked to a lot of counselors about this, but I'm not a counselor, so hear that as a caveat. But to me, true narcissistic behavior is almost incurable,
right?
Short of the gospel itself, right?
Right. Yeah. When you say sooner or later, the house of cards, the where it gets so painful, right, is when it's later, when there's an organization built around this person and decades or more, and then a board that's willing to cover over. Okay, let's talk about the 91%. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, part of the narcissistic behavior, it's a two-way street. The narcissism is fed by our need to have something to worship other than Jesus.
Yeah.
when Moses went up on the mountain to get the Ten Commandments, and he's up there for what, 40 days or something like that. I've been out of practice for a while, but I'm guessing it was about the 39th day that people got tired and they went to Aaron and they said, you remember what they said to him? They said, make for us a God we can see.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of congregations do that to pastors, whether they like it or not. Yeah. That's the God they can see. And so if you get a narcissist, well, that just feeds the monster, right? That just makes it. Now, the self-aware, so different, and not to get all biblical, but like you think about when sin entered the world, it's the first unself-aware narcissistic behavior. I mean, how stupid must Adam and Eve have looked in fig leaves? We've got a fig tree, and I'm telling you, that does not look comfortable or effective. So, and then God confronts them about it, like, hey, where are you? Where are you? First question in the Bible, where are you?
Right.
And, I didn't do it. That woman you gave me made me eat the fruit. Wasn't me. No, snake made me do it. If I sat down and counted the number of people I've interviewed that have said to me, I got fired from that job because I did this wrongly. And now I've figured out how to, cope with that or fix it or not have it happen again. That's like on my hands, I can count that. Yeah. We are so unaware, unwilling to own our junk, which means unwilling to be self-aware. And I think that's kind of what Jesus was driving at when he said, listen, before you go after the splinter in that guy's eye, let's get the log out of your own. Not like you nasty sinner. It's like, just get aware of what your stuff is and then you'll be healthy. And then you're positioned to be the unicorn. But that's, you know, common among unicorns, very uncommon for most of us because we don't want to look at ourselves all that long.
Okay. So last question on self-awareness, and then let's see if we can get a couple more of these habits out of you. 91% of your respondents say that they are more self-aware than 50% of respondents. That's funny. What's their next step? What's the best path for them to become more aware? Like, to me, when I think of self-awareness, William, I think of how am I impacting you? How are you experiencing me? And is that congruent with how I experience myself? How would you coach people to grow in their self-awareness?
Well, this is one of the great things from the book. I think having a group of friends or a source of data that tells you honest opinions about yourself, which is no fun. It's like not fun. But what do I mean when I say that? Do you have, when I was a pastor, I'd say everybody ought to have 5 2 a.m. friends. And that's 5 people you can call at 2 a.m. They'll come get you out of jail. They won't ask questions. They'll just do whatever. But they'll also be honest with you. My best friend I had lunch with yesterday said, I was telling that story, and he was sitting there, and he looked at the guy I was telling the story to and said, I'm the 4 a.m. friend, and I bring a shovel. So, like, that kind of person who will call me on my crap, right? Yeah. And that's very hard to develop. You can't do it instantly. A quicker way is to have an honest tool for 360 reviews on your staff. And you know, anonymous, honest 360 reviews. So we actually went, and you don't know this, but we're releasing right now a software tool that allows you to go test yourself on these 12 areas, these 12 habits. And then there, if you take it, and you're like, okay, that's how I test myself, and it shows how are you against the general population? How are you against the unicorns? And then if you want to get brave, you can turn it into a 360 test where you send it to your boss and send it to someone that works for you, and they can tell you how you stack up on these things. And then you can start to see where you don't have self-awareness and where you can improve. I think it's going to help a lot of teams out there.
Mm, that's so good. And, you know, in the work I do, I think what's encouraging about what you're challenging us on here is the goal isn't to become a perfect person. The goal is to manage your proclivities, you know, which I think all of us actually have the capacity to do. Give us just another one or two of the top 12 traits you found.
Yeah. So, you know, the other one that probably is least common among the general population and steadily common among unicorns, it sounds pedestrian, but it's just responsiveness. How quickly do you get back to people? It's a lot more complicated getting back to people than it used to be. I've given up on some things. I've had to say, I don't respond on Facebook Messenger. I'm really bad at LinkedIn, right? But if you need me to get to you, I need to be able to discern what is a need and then get back to people as quickly as possible when it's a real need. Most people don't respond quickly. And the problem is, in a scattered world where I turn on my phone and I've got to check this platform for these messages and this platform and then email and then text, and the texts fall down in the bottom of your phone and you lose them and you don't ever get around to actually doing anything. It's harder than ever to kind of sort and figure out, how am I going to get back to people? It's also harder to get a response from people if you wait to get back to them. So it's like a double whammy. Like, it's harder for me to get back. But if somebody texts me, they're looking at their phone. And if I go back to them right away, they're going to respond and engage. Now we have a conversation. Most people don't do that. And it's you can't become a tyrant of your inbox. Let your inbox be a tyrant over you. Yeah. But the smart unicorns have figured out systems for discerning when I need to get back to people and doing it right away. And if you've got time, I'll give you one little stat-driven story. Okay. So we use we're a company, not a church. So we use marketing tools. And one of the marketing tools is called HubSpot. It's an inbound marketing. It's where, you know, if you've been on a website and it says, would you like more information, fill out the following form, and somebody will get back with you. That's inbound marketing. So you know, sales and marketing is a lot like evangelism. The point of an evangelism conversation is not to win the person to Jesus right there and then. The point is to get to the next conversation, because it takes 32 points or whatever the latest research is. It's not knock on the door and tell them the four spiritual laws and off we go. So sales is sort of the same way. The point of the sales call is to get to the next sales call. So HubSpot ran a study and they said, I wonder how much response time affects the ability to have that next conversation. Fascinating to think about from an evangelism standpoint.
Yeah.
Okay. So they ran their study and they found people who get a response within 60 seconds, 1 minute of them filling out a form, there's a 98% likelihood that you're going to be able to talk to them again. Now, this is also true, by the way, for first-time donors in your church. You have a very small window where you as the pastor can text them and thank them. You don't even know how much they gave, but like, thank you. Same thing. You're going to get another chance at another conversation. Now, 1 minute, 98%. 20 minutes, what happens if you wait 20 minutes? 60% chance. What happens if you wait an hour? It goes down more. What happens if you wait 24 hours? You have a less than 1% chance of ever hearing from that person again. That's how noisy our world is. And that's how easy it is to win at whether you're growing your volunteer base or your database or your sales and marketing if you're in business. Or get back to people quickly, 98% chance. Wait a day, 1% chance. Then HubSpot went farther. And they said, I wonder what the average response time is from all people using inbound marketing. You know what it was? 42 hours. Less than 1% chance of spending all this money on software, all this money on staff for sales and marketing, and you are literally blowing your opportunity because you're just not responsive. I think the same is true for pastors recruiting volunteers, dealing with first-time donors, certainly evangelism conversations. And if you want to stand out of the crowd, get back to people. Just figure out how to do it in a way that doesn't make your life crazy.
Mm. It's brilliant, William, because there's been a number of times where I've tried to hire a vendor for something. When I stepped out of local church leadership, I'm building a company and a nonprofit. I have both. And that meant I had to learn. It's funny you mentioned nurture campaigns. And so I had to learn all of that stuff. And so occasionally I would try to hire someone who could coach me or do it for me. Things like email campaigns, right? Like it's such a complex world. And there's a handful of times where I would actually follow up with someone and say to them, I am trying to give you my money. Please take my money. Because they simply wouldn't get back to me. They would fall off the cliff somewhere. Or I'm also thinking of Kerry Newhoff. He was on the show most recently when he released his book, At Your Best, my personal favorite energy management book. I just think it's a great book to help people manage their day and energy. And in that book, Kerry talks about doing an inbox inventory. How many ways can people get to you? You were just talking about. That's why we get paralyzed, I think, is we've opened up too many avenues.
I had learned that as a leader because I'm maniacal about getting back to people. But that doesn't, my dysfunction does not set the norm, right? So I had to learn here with our team. We've got about 40 employees full time. We used to just text each other, but then it's like, I better get back in a minute. So for us, here's what I mean by figure out a system. For us, if I email you after hours, right, you can get up and walk across the office and talk to anybody during the day. But after hours, if I email you, the common family understanding in our company is get back to me within 24 hours. Okay. So that means you got to manage your inbox, right? If you Slack me, we use an app called Slack that a lot of people may know, some may not. If you Slack me after hours, that sends up a warning sign. Okay, we're at like DEFCON 4. So, I need an answer pretty quickly. Please get back to me. And I stop what I'm doing if I have to. I mean, if I'm eating meal with my kids, I wait till the meal's over. But it's pretty quick. If you text me after hours, we are at DEFCON 2. And I need to kind of stop what I'm doing the very minute I can and get back to you. If you call me after hours, pick it up. Now, that requires a lot of respect for boundaries on our team. Yeah. Like, you don't get me on a text string about Game of Thrones or whatever show you're watching together, because like, you need to keep the boundaries. But if you can figure out a system where people know how to broadcast to you, I need you now, and then figure out a system to get back to them right then, you will stand out of the crowd as a leader, as a servant, as a staff member. It's just not hard. It's just terribly uncommon.
Folks, I went to seminary in the 1990s, and in many ways, it formed and changed my life in ways that I'm still benefiting from today. One of the most powerful things for me was the way it helped me navigate scripture and make sense of it and get meaning out of it, but also the way it massively expanded my worldview. It's like it gave me more tools in my faith tool belt. What's amazing now in the 2000s, in the 21st century, is you don't have to go to seminary. There's an online streaming platform called Seminary Now, and some of those scholars that I read in books are now available to you and I in these amazing video courses. You can go to seminarynow.com/cuss and put in CUSS30 for a special Managing Leadership Anxiety discount. Ah, so good. Okay, listeners, that's 2 out of the 12. You're going to have to get William's book to get the other 10. But the thing that I would just want to capture for us, William, and then I'd like to shift our conversation a little bit, it's really encouraging to know that these 12 habits can be cultivated. It doesn't mean you have to be born a certain way, wired a certain way, thinking a certain way. So that's Unicorn. There'll be links in the show notes for those who want to grab that and make a difference yourself. I do want to take this opportunity and just explore two topics in either order. One is the reality that you're seeing 3 years post-COVID. The second one, William, is your company has been involved in some of the more public replacements of a pastor after a scandal. I'm thinking of my friend Dave Dummett at Willow Creek Church. And if I understand right, I think Tim Stevens actually helped find Dave and then left you guys and went to work for Dave. Man, two top quality people there. But let's take that second question first. What are you noticing when you're coming into wounded organizations? What are you noticing and what do they need? Yep. Let's start there.
Kind of in a post-pandemic frame.
Well, I think this second question, I know I'm kind of infamous for my convoluted questions. I'm just interested in just you coming into a wounded organization. There's been a scandal or abuse. What do you see and what do they need? Let's start there.
Well, this part of my job is good for my soul because I have had a lifelong wrestling match with pride, and I lose quite often. And this is humbling work when you walk in. You know, when we started our work 15 years ago, there was nobody doing what we did. It was a brand new idea. And we felt so fortunate to get called into any situation. And we'd walk in and say, please tell us what you want us to do. And we're honored to be here. Tell us what to do. Now you walk into, 15 years later, God's been good and we've built a lot of trust and people, we just tend to get those calls. And what's so humbling is to walk in the room and look at this beaten up board and have them look at me and say, tell us what to do. It's a complete flip. So the first thing I do, and I'm not kidding, is pray when I walk into those situations. And I think what I'm realizing, there are certainly some congruences among these situations. Like, you know, most of the time, trust has been beaten up some or destroyed entirely. And so the job of the new leader is to build trust. And poor Dave Dummett had to do that where he couldn't even meet with his staff in person for the first 3 months or 4 months or something like that. So, yeah. And trust had just been destroyed, right?
Yeah.
But I think what's important for me to realize and what I'm learning is, we've done 3,000 searches now. We've worked with like 5,000 churches over the years. And when we hire new people, I have a small part in the onboarding. And, I've gotten to where I'll tell people, here's the thing, 5,000 churches, 3,000 searches, 100 different kind of denominational and non-denominational groups. Let me just tell you, after 15 years, if you've seen one church, you've seen about one church. I think that I'm learning that I have to figure out the uniqueness of the trauma rather than just trying to slot them into a cookie cutter or, I mean, the five ways to recover from trauma in your church. That would be a great little blog post, but it doesn't work. The longer I do search work, the more I am reminded of verses that were not the verses that came to mind when I was pastoring. One is, you know, David said, look, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And he was talking about one individual. Well, what about when you put 100 or 200 or in Willow's case, tens of thousands of individuals into an equation? That's a pretty unique thing. So for me, it's almost like an archaeological dig when you get to a place that's full of trauma. And, you know, they don't use cranes for those things and backhoes. They use brushes. They just gently scratch the surface and see what's there. And I have to become a student of that church to begin to understand what they're going through. And I have, the pride thing, knowing everything at 31, I'm learning to knock that off, you know, the edges a little bit. But I have learned to never, ever say, I know this must be hard. I know what you're going through. I know how you must feel. No, I don't. No, I don't. Don't be so arrogant, William. You know, so for me, when I come into a church that's been in trauma, I think I'm learning that my best posture is one of a student rather than one of a lecturer or prescriptor. And I'm also learning that trust is probably the number one thing that has to be rebuilt. And, you know, I think the number one destroyer of trust is coloring outside the lines, whatever those lines are, right? Some moral failure, if you want to call it that, if you want to, however you describe it in your world. What I didn't know as a young leader was speed can erode trust. So let me unpack that for a minute. So I come in as a young leader at 31. I have a new idea every minute. And this church was, this is Texas, where bigger is better. Let's go grow. Let's go do fun things. And I found over time that I had some people on my staff that didn't trust me. I'm like, I haven't lied to anyone. I'm not doing anything inappropriate. But they don't trust. And I couldn't figure out. And it took some hard work for me to realize, William, you go too fast for some people. And so you have people saying things like, why are you talking so fast? Are you trying to pull one over on me? Are you trying to hide something? So I think maybe one of the biggest mistakes I see of leaders who go into traumatized situations is trying to fix it real fast so that we can get back up on our feet when it's actually counterproductive, because speed can erode trust, and trust and rebuilding trust is like the number one task of the new leader in those situations. Probably more than you want to hear, but That's what I'm learning.
That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Thank you very much. I think particularly your archaeological metaphor is going to stick with me. Don't go in with a crane, go in with a brush. That's a profound idea when you're dealing with people in trauma. Okay, let's talk about, we're having this chat in 2023. We're 3 years post-lockdown part of the pandemic. Maybe you could just give us one concern you have when you look at faith leaders and one opportunity that excites you about faith leaders.
Well, I think, the new reality, whatever that means, I mean, we've had a spike in cases and who knows where that goes, but I think the new reality is maybe the biggest scar tissue I've noticed among church leaders and parishioners from the pandemic was the being left alone. I think even the most introverted people got lonely during the pandemic, right? And some of us, you know, are feeling a little bit like, I understand Noah now. We were locked on a boat for a year together. It was just me and my family. That's a whole nother situation. But I think for the most part, the thing that scarred people was being left alone. And I've thought about this quite a bit. And I realized, you know the first thing God curses? Now, I'm a believer in the power of firsts. The first time something's mentioned in the Bible, the first time a principle's taught, the first things matter. So, first curse in the Bible. Are we back in the Garden of Eden? No. Not with the fruit and the snake and the woman and the man. Actually, before that, God creates the heavens and the earth. Let there be light. Oh, so good. Let there be firmament. So good. Let there be plants and animals. So good. So good. Let there be people. Very so good, right? And then God says, it is not good, which is a malediction. And you remember now, it is not good that man be left alone. God cursed solitude before sin entered the world. We've just come off, even 3 years later, a season of solitude. I think the lesson I'm seeing for pastors and Christians, if you're a new young Christian listening to this podcast, just want to grow, this is for you too. People want to be with people. If Zoom were all it's cracked up to be, why didn't Jesus just Zoom it in, right? No. And I think the effective pastor of the next 10 years is the pastor who knows what's going on in their neighborhood, spends time with their people. It's the shepherds who smell like their sheep. And that sounds like old school, like, no, I need to be crafting a great message. No, you don't. I mean, you should work on preaching the word. It's almost sacramental. But if your people need a world-class message, they can download or live stream any preacher in the world now. They've all figured that out. What they can't do is hear what God's word is speaking about their particular six blocks around the church or however wide your net is. What they can't do is tune into a message while they're sitting in the hospital and have it make them feel better. So, like, I think we're going to return. It's pendulum swing, right? But I think the swing right now, post-pandemic, is towards shepherds that smell like their sheep.
Friends, when we think about making the difference in the lives of vulnerable children, our minds don't often go to 18 to 22-year-olds. But every year in the United States, over 23,000 youth age out of the U.S. foster care system, with no family, no safety net, no resources, and no one to turn to. That's where Dreammakers come in. Dreammakers is on a mission to change the lives of youth who have aged out of the foster care system by connecting their needs with our resources. Even this Christmas, as you're planning your Christmas generosity, you can go to dreammakersproject.org and click on the link Fulfill a Dream. You can make a tangible difference in the life of a young adult, a young man or a young woman, by buying them something tangible like a laptop or a piece of clothing, but also by sending them a note of encouragement to let them know they're not alone. Dreammakersproject.org. All right, William, you were warned or possibly even threatened that in order to come on the Managing Leadership Anxiety podcast, you would have to endure the gauntlet of anxiety questions. This is kind of a rapid fire. The idea is I'll give you four or five questions. Just give us a quick answer. Even though these are kind of deep, the gauntlet, William, has been described as a cross between a roller coaster ride and a proctological exam. So in that spirit, I bring to you the gauntlet. Number one, what is something that you believe you need in the moment that you don't actually need? So for example, for me, people pleasing would be a classic one. I believe in any given moment, I need people to be happy with me when actually I don't need that. What might be something for you?
I think I need to be needed and I don't need to be needed. Okay. I need to build my own replacement. I need to train my own successor. I need to build a ministry and company that can live whether I'm here or not. And I want very badly to be needed, but that's not at all the way Jesus works. He's going to build his church with or without me, and it's probably healthier for me to realize that more. I'm trying to work on that.
Okay, excellent. Number two, all of us bring our family of origin into the workplace, whether we want to or not. What would be one asset and one liability that you carry from your family of origin?
Well, we'll start with me. I'm a firstborn, and that has inherent strengths. You're an achiever. You tend to be rule follower. You tend to go get her done. And then the weakness, starting with me, would be I'm the firstborn, which means I probably think I'm in charge more than I am. And probably I expect more than I should. And I don't know, I might even have some my way or the highway in me that needs to come out. In the larger family of origin, you know, my parents, my parents grew up under the greatest generation. Like their parents all fought in the war and all that. And great, but you know, pendulums swing, right? So my parents were raised in incredibly controlled environments, say it that way. You know, they were maybe over-parented a little bit. So my parents, you know, grew up in the 60s. They kind of went the other way, like, we're not going to over-parent. So that had a downside of not getting as much direct advice as I probably should have, but it had a great strength. And that is, everything I learned, I went and read a book about how to do it and do it. Down to how do I swing a golf club? How do I build a deck? How do I, you know, I had to learn, and they may have been very intentional in this, which is great if they were, but they made me go figure it out rather than waiting on it to be handed to me. So that's the plus and minus of me and plus and minus of the larger family.
So good. Each of us, we encounter personality types or traits in other people that just irritate us. It's just a guarantee. If I'm going to be around this kind of person, I know it's going to trigger irritability in me. What might be a personality trait or a habit that somebody has that just gets under your skin?
I think I'm learning. I hope I'm learning to let things not get under my skin. Was it Lincoln? I'll get the quote wrong. Something like, you can tell the greatness of a man by how great a thing it takes to bother him. And so I'm trying to like be the thermostat, not the thermometer. But I will say two personality types come to mind. One would be me. So entrepreneurs are on the one hand fascinating and wonderful, and on the other hand irritating because they all think they're right and they all think they can bend reality to their will. And it's just so abrasive. And I do the very same thing. So it's like it's pot calling the kettle black, but maybe it's things I need to work on. The second, and I wish this were different, I'm sorry, I'm going to make people mad, but because I am an entrepreneur and a seven and, you know, high DI, the engineers of the world are, I need to learn to be better with them. They're so thorough and everything has to be so exact and right. And I'm just like, it's 80% right. Let's move on. But I have learned in this phase of my career to surround myself with those people. We would never have the data for 30,000 interviews had I not surrounded myself with the people that are absolutely not like me.
Fantastic. Okay, you are sailing through. I'm very uncomfortable when my guest sails through the gauntlet, but we have two more questions. One of the things we help people understand on this podcast and when I'm doing my workshops is that chronic anxiety has a gospel. And it's competing with the gospel of Jesus. And so therefore, this fill in the blank can be helpful. What if I were at least as blank to myself as God is? What if I were at least as blank to myself as God is? For me, it would almost always be patient.
That's a great question. What if I were to be as loving as God is? You talk about the scandals and the trauma-driven churches, and you know, you mentioned one that, yes, it was bad, but I've seen a lot worse. And not to compare trauma, right? But there are nights, and I say this in our training when we hire new people, there will be nights where you will go home and say, Jesus, you have the craziest taste in brides. And I need to stop all that. Because Jesus says, no, this is the bride. I chose her. I love her. You need to do the same and quit judging. And that doesn't mean don't have theological frameworks about what's right and wrong. But like, I think I need to be as loving as God is.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, so then that leads to that final question. when in your life recently have you felt most fully and completely loved? And it doesn't have to be a mystical God answer. It can be something people have answered before with a hobby or a pet or a family member. But just when recently have you felt most fully and completely loved? What was happening?
Yeah. Well, the first thing that flashes in my mind, Adrian and I just had one of those round number anniversaries, you know, kind of one of the bigger ones. We went away for the weekend and it was just, you know, a marriage is roller coaster, right? And Dave Ramsey says, William, the only people that get hurt on roller coasters are the ones who don't fasten their seatbelt. So, you know, but it was just one of those special times where the whole weekend, I'm not talking about any particular time, nor am I going to tell you what was going on at any particular time. But the whole weekend was really, really special. Yeah. Yeah. I felt like I belonged.
Mm. Yeah. William Vanderblumen, thank you so much for joining me on the show. The book is Be the Unicorn, 12 Data-Driven Habits That Separate the Best Leaders from the Rest. That's one of many books that William has written, not just to help leaders, but church boards and pastors. He spent the last 15 years serving the local church. William, thanks for coming on the show. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Thanks, Steve. I really appreciate you having me, and I'm so thankful for the work you're doing to help pastors be healthier, which helps the church go farther and faster.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.